restaurant food on a level beyond imagining, thanks primarily to the rise of a new style of cooking commonly referred to as Nouvelle Cuisine. The movement was first trumpeted as such in Le Nouveau Guide, the brainchild of food critics Henri Gaulle and Christian Millau, who founded the Guide with André Gaillot. The Guide debuted in 1969, in part as a response to what the authors saw as the staid Guide Michelin, which had been evaluating restaurants according to its three-star scale since 1931. Gaulle and Millau contended that Michelin had failed to praise an emerging new guard of French chefs who broke away from the time-worn canon of haute cuisine recipes first codified by Escoffier in Le Guide Culinaire in 1903. "Michelin, don't forget these 48 stars," screamed the first issue's hand-scrawled headline, accompanying an image of chefs, including Paul Bocuse, Michel Gérard, and Louis Outhier, who were changing the construct of French cuisine, abandoning the Escoffier playbook in favor of a freer, more personal style. The best-known edition of the Guide was the 1973 issue featuring an article revolutionarily titled Vive la Nouvelle Cuisine. In it, the authors put forth not only the name of the movement itself, but also distilled it down, with religious undertones, into the 10 commandments. The list seems quaint, but at a time when food was tiptoeing away from platter service and tableside carving to the style of dishes plated by the chef in the kitchen that has endured and evolved through today, it was transformative. The 10 commandments included such rules as simplifying where possible, reducing cooking times, cooking seasonally, employing lighter sauces, rediscovering regional dishes, availing oneself of modern equipment such as nonstick pans, cooking with diet and health in mind, and being inventive. There's just one problem. Like most culinary catch-alls, Nouvelle Cuisine oversimplifies, emphasizing certain aspects of the trend while omitting the nuance and individuality that distinguishes any chef. Created by journalists to corral electrifying but disorienting change into a manageable construct, the term Nouvelle Cuisine was promotable but confusing. Mimi Sheridan, restaurant critic for the New York Times from 1975 to 1983, suggests discarding the delineated elements in favor of the less specific, literal translation of Nouvelle Cuisine, New Cuisine. In the case of Gaulle and Millau, the name they assign their movement conveniently echoed the name of their publication. In today's parlance, Nouvelle Cuisine might have been considered a brand extension of Le Guide Nouveau. The movement was also commonly and unhelpfully confused in the United States with Cuisine Minceur, or slimming food, the specialty of chef Michel Gérard, also one of the chieftains of Nouvelle Cuisine. Despite these shortcomings, the name Nouvelle Cuisine stuck. One of its defining underpinnings was the visibility of the practitioners of this bold new style, the chefs whose personal marks showed in their dishes. The inaugural cover of the Guide depicted close to 50 toques at a time, when you'd have been hard-pressed to name more than a handful. Just as each commandment involves some version of the words nouveau, découvrir, and invention, often multiple times, many of them also illustrate their principles with preparations associated with specific chefs. Nouvelle Cuisine carved out some independence for the chef, writes Nathan Myhrvold. Escoffier and Marie-Antoine, Carême before him, had explicitly sought to establish rules and conventions. Nouvelle Cuisine gave more leeway to the individual chef. The simplified historical storyline is that the Nouvelle Cuisine chefs began the shift to a more personalized cuisine. But Fernand Poiant deserves much credit, not only for shifting to a new style before the Nouvelle Cuisine era, but also for mentoring many of the chefs who would congregate under its umbrella. Bocuse, Gérard, and brothers Jean and Pierre Toigros all apprenticed for him in the late 1940s and early 1950s. Poiant devised a new menu each day, rendered in dramatic script by his wife, Marie-Louise Mado Poiant, a new approach for the time. "If I take a little step back, I think Fernand Poiant is the beginning of the story," says San Francisco chef Roland Passot, a native of Villefranche-sur-Saône in eastern France. "He was that figure, that man who was drinking champagne at 8 in the morning, By noon, he'd already have had 2 or 3 bottles. People were flying in from all over the world. He had presidents of France and other countries coming to his restaurant. Poin's morning champagne ritual has been romanticized by many. Less frequently cited is his short lifespan. He died at age 58 in 1955. But there's no doubt that Paul Bocuse was the visionary of his generation and understood the value of moving chefs into the public eye. "Bocuse was very street smart," says Passot. "It came to him naturally. He was like the godfather of those chefs. He was the one who was leading the pack. I think he was the driving machine of getting chefs out of their kitchens. I don't want to call them rebels, but they were my idols." And he got together in force with that group of chefs, Michel Gérard, Roger Verger, even Gaston Lanotte, to really expose themselves and to show chefs not just cooking behind the stove, but being business people and celebrities. That was a turn. Bocuse, in addition to being an innate and master marketer, traveled the world, maintained relationships with chefs in many countries, employed Japanese cooks in his restaurant before others in France were doing it. He also went where no French chef of his stature had gone before, visiting the United States to perform cooking demonstrations and participate in special dinners that garnered press coverage and furthered the cause. Americans were seduced by Nouvelle Cuisine, both for the personality in the food itself and the attention paid to the chefs, which altered their perception of the profession and put faces to the movement. And some of those Americans could imagine themselves in kitchen whites. David Leiderman, a New York City college student, was so dazzled by his meal at La Maison Trois Gros that he made a bet with Jean Trois Gros that if he could beat him in tennis, he could return and work in the kitchen. Jonathan Waxman remembers being in France in his 20s and seeing 4 Nouvelle Cuisine leaders on the cover of Paris Match magazine. "I said, 'That looks pretty cool,' he says. 'Being a chef. Being on the cover of a magazine.'" A useful counterpoint is the experience of the late Judy Rogers, best known as the chef of San Francisco's Zuni Café, who spent a year living with the Trois Gros family in Rouen, France, from 1973 to 1974. Though she never officially worked in their restaurant kitchen, she did occasionally help with rudimentary prep work there, tasted their full repertoire, received culinary wisdom directly from the brothers, and recorded every recipe in her notebooks. Despite such extraordinary access, she responded more to the food she ate outside the restaurant's dining room.
"About 3 weeks into my stay at Trois Gros, I know that I preferred staff meal to dining in the dining room. I loved the experience of dining in the dining room, and it came off beautifully. And the food was, frankly, a lot simpler and more sort of easy and enjoyable to eat than a 3-star meal in Paris or a 3-star at Bocuse. But still, I knew that for me, the dining experience, the conviviality of the food that I was eating at staff meal or at Jean's sister's, where she was doing traditional Burgundian food for the most part, I just liked that better. My body liked it better, and I was a strapping 16-year-old. I could eat anything, but I knew I liked that better. Plus, it just struck me at that point in my life that, my God, I was already 16, and there was no way I was going into food. And the stuff that they did after 7 o'clock in the kitchen was something that you had to begin training for at age 14. And I was over the hill."
It was almost like an underground. Alice Waters. Most accountings of this subject in this era begin, compulsorily, with Alice Waters's Che Panisse. Mention the modern American restaurant movement, or even contemporary American cuisine, to the casual observer, and it's the first restaurant most will toss out. But Che Panisse wasn't the first establishment of its kind in America. It wasn't even the first in Berkeley, where it was predated by The Potluck, purchased by Hank Rubin in 1962, and by Narsai's, a restaurant by Rubin's one-time kitchen manager, Narsai David. Potluck was doing regional French menus on Monday nights way before Jeremiah Tower or Alice Waters did, said Chef Mark Miller. For more of-the-moment cuisine, there was Bruce Lefebvre's The Paragon in Aspen, Colorado. A native of Amsterdam, New York, Lefebvre had dropped out of Dartmouth College to join the Army, did a tour of duty in counterintelligence in eastern France, taking in the sights and food of Burgundy, Alsace, and Paris in his off hours. He fell in love with Europe, backpacked around, then stayed in France for 3 years. Returning stateside for a friend's wedding, he was so taken with Colorado that he decided to stay and write a novel, but couldn't secure a publisher. In the meantime, he had married, had a child, and was confronted with bills to pay. He and his wife, Patricia, opened a restaurant with him as the chef, modeling his food on the not-yet-named Nouvelle Cuisine he'd sampled in his travels. The restaurant was intimate, comprising private rooms. The year was 1965. On the East Coast, a fondness for both Italy and France guided John Novi, an Italian-American artist, preservationist, and self-proclaimed hippie, who purchased the Dupuy Canal House, an 18th-century structure in High Falls, New York, and spent 5 years renovating it with plans to convert it into a restaurant. He refinished the interior with the help of volunteer teens from a local civic association. A radio blasted music while they worked. Simon and Garfunkel's Mrs. Robinson in particular takes him back. "It was a free-for-all," he says of those days, when he hosted all-night jam sessions and parties in the unfinished space. "Everybody loved everybody. I was living instinctively and following what my mother used to call my destiny. And I look back on my life now and I realize that's exactly what I did. I was very natural, and I wanted to work as naturally as possible with food." In 1968, he visited Europe, taking a circuitous route to his family's native country. "I just wanted to live in Italy with my relatives. I drove south, went into Austria, Brussels, and then I went to France, stayed in hostels, and worked my way down to the family." Novi only spoke broken Italian, but after a month found work in a kitchen at an Italian restaurant with an American name, The Picnic. He assimilated the European service style. "I learned, number one, courses. I couldn't compare it to anything, to my parents. And when I came back, I opened up with a 7-course meal. I learned to serve the salad after the entree, not before. I loved the whole idea. I would splurge and go into a fine dining restaurant on my way down to Italy. And I found these carts come to the table loaded with cheese, and I just loved that idea. I had to do that here." He was able to get cheese from Robert Schneller in Kingston, New York, where he also bought his meat. Novi recalls an epiphany when he found himself in possession of a sea bass. A 20-pound fish, the objective being to fillet it properly, needed study, and I had to do it right. I'm a perfectionist. And so, just like that, he decided to become a chef. 8 months after the restaurant opened in 1969, it received 4 stars from Craig Claiborne, the New York Times, which puzzles Novi to this day. "We were busy, and it was a Sunday night. They had dinner, and then they went into the bar, and they ordered drinks. It was just a strange happening because, number one, Craig Claiborne ordered a margarita at the table, and it went out to Susan, who was our barmaid at the time, Susan Hines. And Susan went up to him. She said, 'I'm really sorry, but I don't know how to make a margarita.' So she said, 'Do you mind coming into the bar and making it?' So Craig Claiborne went into the bar, went behind the bar, and made his own margarita, and taught her how to make a margarita. And he ends up in the article calling her the demure barmaid. So how he ended up with 4 stars. Those restaurants are long gone and largely forgotten, as is Lefebvre's later effort, the well-regarded Rose A. Lefebvre in St. Helena, California. But Chez Panisse abides, to put it mildly. The restaurant has risen to legend status, and many people reading this are no doubt familiar with much of its lore. As Manresa's David Kinch said to me in an interview, "People know who Willie Bishop is," referring to the bearded beatnik painter who cooked at Chez Panisse in the early 1970s. It has launched countless careers, and working there became a rite of passage for several generations of mostly California-based cooks and chefs. It's also widely credited with at least one evolution in American restaurant practice. What Chez Panisse did, not when they first opened, but as they found their own identity, was revolutionary because it was a restaurant that wrote menus based on what was available, says Coleman Andrews. Every other restaurant wrote menus and then found ways to make it available. And if you couldn't get it fresh or you couldn't get a top thing, you got the second best. Or if you couldn't get fresh, you got it frozen or canned or whatever. Or you say, oh, tonight we're out of this. But that was even before the idea of sourcing organic produce from the small farmers. The idea that what you found, even if it was what you found at the wholesale market, determines what you're going to cook. Gee, really? Okay. And it certainly wasn't the first place to do this, but it was also kind of revolutionary in that there was no fondue cuisine. There were no stocks made up. There were no sauces. Everything was a la minute, or pan sauce, or sauceless, or something. And those things had a tremendous influence. Waters herself has used her platform to advocate for food-related issues worldwide, and in the process taken on an almost messianic air. Over the near half-century since Chez Panisse's debut, founder and restaurant have become inseparable. I didn't know what to expect when I met Alice Waters, for whom I made a trip cross-country for a 3-hour audience. I arrive at the restaurant in the early afternoon of a mid-August weekday. My sense of her was deeply developed enough from afar that I didn't scroll through the usual options when I walked upstairs and asked the hostess at the casual Chez Panisse Café to announce me to her office. I didn't ask for Chef Waters, as some houses expect, or Miss Waters. Alice is expecting me, seemed and was appropriate. I was led to a table in the window of the dining room facing out onto Shattuck Avenue. There was, set out for me, a glass teapot, loose herbs suspended in the water within, tinging it. Waters appeared, and we shook hands, sat across from each other. I confess that where I usually ask subjects to recount their entire story for me, this was one case where I didn't, because her time was limited, but also because there's no single figure in the restaurant community in the United States whose biography has been more well-documented, whose formative moments have taken on more an air of folktale. It also must be said, as others who have been down this road before me too have noted, that for every Chez Panisse loyalist, there's a detractor who will privately, sometimes bitterly, grouse that for all of its influence on the industry and on the eating habits and food knowledge of Americans, both restaurant and founder have been inflated historically, but won't go on the record with their grievances. Happily, our focus here is not the American restaurant or American food, but the evolution of the American chef. And where that arc is concerned, Chez Panisse's early days offer a useful and unambiguous case study in how, and how quickly, things changed. Waters' story traces, personifies, all of the aforementioned influences. Born in Chatham, New Jersey on April 28, 1944, she grew up with only the most tangential interest in food. I didn't think about it very much because I grew up in New Jersey, and my family rarely went out to dinner, she says. We were 6 of us, and we just didn't have the money to go out to dinner. So I can't say that I had much of an idea, except we always wanted to go and eat ice cream at Howard Johnson's. And I liked to go to New York for my birthday every year. I wanted to go to the Museum of Natural History, and to eat at the Automat because I wanted to be able to choose what I wanted to eat and then have it right away. And I just loved the lemon meringue pie being cut and put on the tray and opening the door. It was a big thing for me. But I really didn't know much about the restaurant business at all.
The family had a garden.
But I was a picky eater. I had to come to the dinner table, but they kept wanting me to eat food that didn't taste good in my mind. I mean, when I think back, my mother wasn't a cook, and she had a hard time taking care of her kids. I loved corn on the cob and tomatoes right out of the garden, and when my father grilled steaks. But I had parfait pie and mince pie at Thanksgiving, because my mother knew how to make a pie crust really well.
Her father worked for the Prudential Life Insurance Company, which required relocations to Indiana and then to Van Nuys in Southern California. She matriculated at the University of California, Santa Barbara, then transferred with friends to UC Berkeley in 1964.
We arrived sort of front and center of the free speech movement, she says. I just felt like I was in over my head, that I was in a really big city that I didn't know about, and I was sort of holding on to my friends pretty much.
She recalls,
a lot of drugs,
A lot of parties going on simultaneously. I was a little bit into Ferlinghetti and that sort of beatnik side.
In 1965, she and a friend traveled to Paris for a semester at the Sorbonne, setting up camp in the second arrondissement. She was immediately overtaken by the sensuality of France, especially the food, from her morning café au lait, pastries and yogurt, to the oysters, onion soups, and bistro fare.
I would call it my awakening. It was just unlike anything I'd ever experienced, she says.
That summer, she traveled through the south of France and discovered its distinct culinary pleasures, the traditional variety, founded on olive oil, herbs, garlic, and vegetables. Back in the States, she began cooking, turning for guidance to Julia Child's television show and to the books of Elizabeth David, especially French provincial cooking, which she cooked through from cover to cover. She fell in love with graphic designer David Goines, a free speech movement leader, and moved in with him. Food became a part of their lives. They were close with Charles Scheer, a musicologist, and his wife, Lindsay Scheer, a passionate baker. They'd have roaming dinner parties, savory courses prepared by Waters at her and David's. Then, a stroll over to the Scheers for dessert. But cooking was just a passion. It would never, she says, have occurred to her to go into the restaurant business.
I got very involved with Vietnam, she says. I was kind of an assistant to Bob Scheer, and I traveled around with him, took him every place he spoke. I was very, very influenced by his thinking, and very, very disappointed when he lost when he ran for Congress.
Waters graduated Berkeley in January 1967, and wasn't sure what to do with herself. At another time, she says, she would have followed a conventional path.
I probably would have said, I'm going to be a housewife like my older sister. I didn't even have an ambition to work. I figured I'd be a mother.
She tried a job in a restaurant, The Quest, but it had none of the magic of those Paris bistros, and she didn't last long.
So I taught school, and then I went and took Montessori training. But I really felt that public education was incredibly valuable, and we had to support it. We had to participate in it. And even though I was learning Montessori, and it was a private school and a special way of seeing the world, it just fit perfectly with my whole edible education that I had in France, that I was touching and tasting and smelling and seeing all of this around me. I only stopped teaching because I left that job.
As they did for so many in Berkeley, art and food began to intertwine for Waters, like a double helix. She started a recipe column in the San Francisco Express-Times, Alice's Restaurant, named for the Arlo Guthrie song. Each column was a recipe, written in prose by Waters and graphically designed by Goines in a style that would help define the visual identity of Chez Panisse.
There was a lot in print happening, both in terms of posters and communications that was sort of binding us as a group of young people, trying to stop the war in Vietnam and caring about civil rights, she says. It was almost like an underground. I mean, I always thought I was part of a counterculture. And I still feel like I'm part of a counterculture. Truly. Deeply.
I asked Waters how she connects the larger shifts of the 1960s with an elevated sense of food and its possibilities.
I think a big part of it is just in our genes, she says. There's certain things that are universal, and eating is one of those. I think the impulse to come to the table and communicate with other people is as old as civilization. I think the idea of cooking locally is certainly no new idea. That's been here always. So these values, once they're awakened, you can't go back. You just go forward. You want to be hospitable, and cooking and the table are a big part of that. And you're experimenting. I'm sure a lot of people came to it the same way I did, which was through an experience like going to France. I know that Elizabeth David did that. Julia Child did that. Many, many people. They traveled and or they had parents that had traveled or were influential. And they came back and they just said, you know, I want to do this. I want to have a table like this. I want to cook for my friends.
After breaking up with Goines, Waters dated Tom Luddy, a film producer and director of the Pacific Film Archive, and they'd stage get-togethers with friends. Waters would cook. Luddy would screen a movie. He introduced her to the film adaptations of playwright Marcel Pagnol's 1930s Marseille trilogy. Marius, 1931, Fanny, 1932, and Caesar, 1936. I asked Waters about two phrases regarding food in Berkeley that were repeated in multiple interviews for this book. At the time, there was a culture of food, and food could change the world. Many attribute the latter to Waters.
Well, it's very interesting, she said. I didn't realize that Mario Savio, head of the free speech movement, was Sicilian. I didn't hear about his life until he died in his 50s, in 1996. And I just loved hearing at his memorial that he was drinking a bottle of wine every night with dinner with his friends. And surely he had Italian food on the table. And he brought a very big vision of this idealistic world, made it real for all of us who were listening to him. But there was a movement in Berkeley, from back in the 60s, that was probably connected to growing grass, but it was more than that. It was like, grow your own. You don't have to be dependent on these big fast food industries. It was the weaving of politics and food that's sort of the commune that we can eat vegetables, you can be vegetarian. That was a big part of it. But back before Chez Panisse began, the cheese board and Pete's Coffee, Tea and Spices were already places in Berkeley. So I knew I wanted to be in this neighborhood. I lived not far away. I think there were a lot of people eating with intention. Whether it was well or not, it was with intention. So as people became more educated and traveled, they became more sophisticated.
There was also this other thing called the Swallow Cafe, says L. John Harris. The Swallow Cafe gave birth to writers, not chefs, interestingly. So S. Irene Verbala of the L.A. Times, Ruth Reichel, myself, Maggie Klein, all were at the Swallow Cafe, and many others who didn't go on. The Swallow was almost like a pre-Chez Panisse in the sense that it was people who loved working with food, but wanted to do it in a way that was real and authentic. It was started by a cheese board person. By then, the cheese board had become a collective business, which was the influence of the owners having lived in Israel and spending time on a kibbutz. The idea was that collectivization was the way to save humanity. So you limit profit, but you spread authority. Everybody gets an equal share of everything, and you work it out through consensus. There was no hierarchy of authority. So the Swallow was like a step toward Chez Panisse in a funny way. And it was connected to the film archives physically. So there was this whole Tom Luddy connection, and then that spread itself through Chez Panisse, named for the widower Panisse in the Pagnol films. In 1971, Waters decided to take the leap and open the restaurant that had been gestating in her mind, one that would recreate the pleasures of food and the table she'd come to appreciate in France.
It's funny. It didn't seem a big leap at all, she says today.
Maybe this was in part because, as it had for Martyr, LSD gave Waters a nudge.
I only did LSD once, she says. It was mind-altering, and all of a sudden, I understood what Bob Dylan was saying. It was a kind of blowing your mind, if you will. Just not seeing the world in that same way. I just thought, my friends are coming over, and I'm cooking for them, and they aren't paying, and I can't teach anymore. And it's what I had a passion for. I cooked every night. I thought, well, I can just open a restaurant. I was empowered. Really empowered by the counterculture. I felt like I could open it up and people would come.
But for all of the influence Chez Panisse would exert on the restaurant and food industries, the role of a chef was largely incidental at the restaurant's first iteration. Chez Panisse's first chef was not the icon Waters, less a chef than, in the words of Bay Area chef and California food historian Joyce Goldstein, a restaurateur and a spiritual leader and an activist. But the virtually unknown Victoria Croyer, now Wise, a graduate student at UC Berkeley, who had burned out and decided to throw in the academic towel. By chance, she had much in common with Waters. She'd been caught up in the free speech movement, been to France, loved to cook. An ex-boyfriend happened by the space while it was being renovated, told her to hightail it over there and apply for a job. Wise landed the gig without so much as an audition menu.
I really was the first one, and nobody had the presence of mind to suggest that, says Wise,
who was hired after an interview with Waters' friend and restaurant investor Paul Eritow and his friend Bobby Weinstein.
We were running around trying to get silverware for the table. There was a leak in the refrigerators, and we tried to have at least one counter in the kitchen free so that we could set something down. It was chaotic and hilarious. Isn't that crazy?
Lindsay Shear was appointed pastry chef at a time when even many more formal establishments didn't enlist a dedicated dessert specialist.
If you're the head of the stoves in a restaurant, well, you're the chef, says Wise. That's all. But it was exactly the informality of its manifestation that it just was so different. It was freer. If people assumed that being a chef was like coming out of a hotel school or hospitality school, it was not like that. It was much more freewheeling, frankly. And now, of course, there are culinary schools all over the place, and they're active and they're full. But there weren't such things then. I think there was the Culinary Institute of America at Hyde Park. That was it. And that was the formal training. We were a bunch of people, you know, kind of smart-ass college kids saying, well, of course we can cook. We've been to France. We know what it tastes like. And off we went.
For a sense of the bi-coastal nature of the zeitgeist, consider another restaurant, one that opened in New York City among the industrial lofts below Houston Street, many of them occupied illegally by artists, just 4 months after Chez Panisse in December 1971. The restaurant was, appropriately enough, called Food, and it was created by artist Gordon Maddox Clark and his girlfriend, photographer and dancer Carol Gooden, as a sort of edible installation. Maddox Clark wasn't a chef, not in the way we understand the role today. He was an artist, one who personified the burgeoning Soho art scene. Among his claims to fame was an architecture, which was, according to his friend, sculptor Ned Smythe, a dramatically physical deconstructivist architecture, rather ahead of its time. A sort of inner-city Cristo, Maddox Clark created conceptual pieces such as Cuts, for which he and Smythe cut pieces out of walls of abandoned buildings in the South Bronx, then photographed the altered space, ideally with a window at the far end. If the cityscape and the cutout featured an elevated subway car, all the better. He and Smythe lugged saws, power tools, and a generator into the buildings, sometimes encountering fully furnished dwellings that looked as if the occupants had simply walked out. That was spooky, but it was nothing compared to the threat of encountering junkies who would steal copper wire and pipe to sell as scrap to get money for drugs. Though he usually got away with his missions, his cutting of a Hudson River pier necessitated him leaving the country for a spell. Maddox Clark also shared of himself via food. The story of the restaurant began on the afternoon he sliced meat from a slow-roasted pig, slapped it between the slices of bread, and handed out pork sandwiches to hundreds of people participating in Under the Brooklyn Bridge, an alternative space art show. The day prior to the show, Gooden procured a suckling pig from the Jones Street meat market. They injected it with pepper water, jury-rigged a grill, lit a fire with branches from the swamps of New Jersey, hung a hammock, and spent 18 hours under the bridge, tending to the pig. The next day, as a saxophone player provided the living soundtrack, Mabou Mines performed a Beckett play, and Tina Gerard fashioned a house from dirt, Maddox Clark sliced the pork and served approximately 500 people sandwiches. Food was the love child of food and art that was part and parcel of the downtown art scene. There was also the dinner party circuit to which Maddox Clark and Gooden belonged. One memorable party Gooden hosted in her loft was the spring flower party, a theme guests freely interpreted by bringing flowers, bringing edible flowers, or coming dressed as flowers. Maddox Clark made the semi-joking suggestion that Gooden should open a restaurant. She liked the idea of not giving food away, so she said that she'd do it if he did. Within a week, she negotiated to take over the space of 127 Prince Street, at the corner of Wooster Street, that housed Comidas Criollas, a failing eatery. The couple, with fellow artists, opened Food, which blended art, cooking, utopian philosophy, and counterculture in a restaurant unlike any the city had seen. At the time, Soho was an undeveloped frontier of named streets beneath Upper Manhattan's numbered system, and there were scant few restaurants, mainly just Finelli Cafe. Says Bill Katz, who would go on to design Chanterelle Restaurant at the tail end of the decade, "It wasn't Soho then. It wasn't called Soho. Soho came later. That's a real estate term. This was before that." Food was on the northwest corner of Prince and Wooster, says Katz. "And it's mythic because he had artists who would cook, and they would cook the most far-out things you ever could imagine. That was the first restaurant in our neighborhood." As at Chez Panisse, the concept of a chef was more necessity than focus at Food, which served a vegetarian menu two nights a week, and welcomed guest chefs, including artists such as Robert Rauschenberg. And the training that would in time become de rigueur for New York City whisks was far from a prerequisite. In August 1971, Smythe, freshly arrived in New York City, having hitchhiked from Colorado, answered a notice in Food's window and spoke with Gooden.
"You can be a waiter or busboy," said Gooden, "but what I really need is an assistant chef."
"What do I have to do?" asked Smythe.
"Can you chop and boil vegetables?"
"Yes." He was hired. When Food opened, there was no telephone. The windows were still soaped, and the dining room, all white walls, high ceilings and square oak tables under which 40 to 50 mismatched chairs were tucked, was still a construction site. Soups and stews were served from a cauldron in the center of the room. The menu changed nightly and ran the gamut. Soup accompanied by house-made breads and fresh, notably unsalted butter. Chicken stew over rice and shrimp gumbo. There were conceptual dinners that would have been right at home in the 2010s. Matta Clark's Bone Dinner remains legendary. A meal of oxtail soup, roasted marrow bones, and other dishes. At the end of the meal, the bones were scrubbed clean and strung together to be worn home by guests. At another, he served live shrimp swimming in egg whites. The dish was titled Alive. Eat your heart out, Rene Redzepi. Graphic designer Milton Glaser and his co-columnist Jerome Snyder, writing in their Underground Gourmet column in New York Magazine, rhapsodized about Food, which they described as a restaurant commune. The last line of the review, quoting a woman at Food who recognized Glaser, spoke to the non-commercial idealism of the day.
"Please don't write about this place," she pleaded.
Food, at least in its first incarnation, had a short life, just 3 years. Gooden sold the space, and the new owners kept the name. Gooden couldn't stop them because it was so generic. Matta Clark died of pancreatic cancer at age 35 in 1978. Despite the similarities between Chez Panisse and Food, Gooden said that Waters' restaurant had no influence on Food, although she thinks she may have used some recipes from the Moosewood Cookbook, from the vegetarian restaurant that opened in Ithaca, New York, in 1973, during Food's lifespan. Years later, she said she still didn't know much about Chez Panisse. Gooden, a native of England, said that she and Matta Clark were more influenced by European food, / cooking, / shopping, / presentation, and the social place of Food in European life. There were, at the time, comparable restaurants elsewhere downtown. In particular, Gooden cited a like-minded delicatessen on Second Avenue, and a restaurant called either the Back Porch or the Front Porch, which,
"oddly, kind of had the same ideas as we did. Fresh food, homemade food, soups and sandwiches, stews, inexpensive, casual. But they didn't influence us, nor we them."
Just as Waters found opening a restaurant to be the most natural thing in the world, Wise thought little of morphing into a chef.
"It didn't seem a big deal to me either, to assume the role of a chef. I mean, I was cooking. That's what I was doing."
Chez Panisse, as restaurants do, came together. There were red and white checkered tablecloths, mismatched silver, flea market chairs and fresh flowers. And the opening, as openings are, was chaos. Just before opening night, Alice walked into the cheese board and said, "I need help," remembers L. John Harris, who pitched in as a waiter. When the night arrived, Waters, in a polka-dot dress from the Bazaar Bazaar, was still nailing a runner to the stairs as customers were queued up outside. Nobody had thought to make a sign, so Goines wrote "Chez Panisse" with chalk in angular block letters on the wooden fence outside. The opening menu was pâté en croûte, canard aux olives, and a plum tart. Waters, Wise and Company didn't even know there was such a thing as restaurant purveyors.
"There were a lot of ethnic markets in San Francisco, and at the beginning of the restaurant, we felt that was the place to shop because the ducks were hanging," says Waters.
They also purchased food from a Japanese produce concession at the USAVE on Grove Street and from the Berkeley Co-op. The restaurant was sincere but rough around the edges, to put it mildly, without the air of institution or the high-mindedness that attaches to it today.
Alice, I think, would probably be the first person to tell you that Chez Panisse today is not the Chez Panisse that Alice built, not the Chez Panisse that Alice expected, not the Chez Panisse that Alice wanted, says Narsai David. I mean, it has evolved into something far beyond anything that she had ever dreamt of. She started out doing a very, very casual, very simple, straightforward place, where the kitchen had the freedom to come up with new ideas and play with different things. And she just made an enormous contribution. But it, at the same time, was, well, in a funny way, it was almost a little too touchy-feely, you know? The silverware was bought used at flea markets and such. I don't mind the fact that the silverware didn't match. But when the silver plating had worn off and you had the brass or copper base metal on your tongue, it just didn't feel right. It certainly was not a heavy enough reaction that it interfered with her success. I mean, from day one, she was successful.
Waters' main role in those first days was technically as a waitress, selling the set menu to customers. The restaurant was initially open from breakfast until late night, but quickly became a dinner-only affair. One customer in those early days was Mark Miller, a UC Berkeley graduate student studying art history and Japanese anthropology. Born and raised in Massachusetts, Miller had come to Berkeley in 1967. As a break from the rigors of academia, he began cooking out of the New York Times cookbook and a paperback of one of James Beard's books. Miller, a friend of Wise's, would become a part of the fabric of Chez Panisse, often hanging around the kitchen after hours, kibitzing with the staff. He would also go on to start a sophisticated and strikingly designed newsletter, Market Basket, which reviewed food products such as soy sauce and chocolate, long before it was fashionable. Early reviews for the restaurant were positive. Wise left Chez Panisse, temporarily to follow a boyfriend to Montreal, then after a brief return, for good. In a melding of food and cinema, she became Francis Ford Coppola's private chef, then opened Pig by the Tail, a charcuterie shop on the same block as Chez Panisse in what became known as Berkeley's Gourmet Ghetto. The restaurant placed an ad, interviewed four candidates to replace Wise. Then, a fifth emerged, Jeremiah Tower. It's a sign of how fraught his relationship with the restaurant would become, that even the story of his audition is disputed. As he tells it, he showed up at Chez Panisse and was asked to taste a soup. He found that it only needed salt, but dolled it up with wine and cream to show off. Waters took one slurp and hired him. Others who were there insist he went through a more lengthy process, including writing several proposed menus. However he got the gig, Waters and Tower produced an alchemy that rocketed the restaurant to new heights. Tower, a Harvard grad and food obsessive who had dined all over the world, read menus like novels, studied them like texts, and had regularly thrown extravagant dinner parties in Cambridge, came to the task with a fervor, creating ambitious menus, and working with Waters to procure the necessary ingredients to prepare them. The two also began a dalliance, indulging in champagne and caviar after hours, and sleeping together, which got people's attention because Tower, though not yet out, was gay. The reason Jeremiah became prominent, or was able to, is that he was in a highly liberal political construct in Berkeley, because Alice thought she could make him straight, says Clark Wolf, a restaurant consultant who was around the Berkeley food scene. It was a real simple situation. He was willing to trade that part of it for opportunity. And by that I mean he was willing to flirt, which is a very minor term for a much more complex situation, right? Alice, I think she believes that it's just a phase, with anybody. And I love Alice very much, and I respect her, but that can only be self-involvement. If you don't understand somebody else's actual reality, it's only because you can't go beyond your own. Tower transformed the kitchen immediately, ordered that the rock and roll and the stereo be replaced by opera. He began crafting menus the likes of which hadn't been seen anywhere, marrying his academic cleverness with his depth of culinary knowledge. Within days, he was offering obscure French preparations, and before long the menu, written in French in Waters' calligraphy, was paired with a typewritten sheet featuring English translations, something that hadn't been necessary in Chez Panisse's more culinarily conservative early days. In service of the food, the odd couple scoured the Bay Area for ingredients, sourcing from Italian delis, meat markets, fish shops, and also welcoming an early generation of foragers who would bring them mushrooms, fruits, eggs, and other ingredients. The two of them really were the two scientists, or the mother and father of what we are really talking about now, says Jonathan Waxman. I think that Alice had always had a vision about what she wanted. Auberge of the Flowering Hearth is a very strong influence on her. She has lots of influences. The idea of cooking food in one's home that was really of the earth. It has always been Alice's vision. Whether it was pure French food or regional food of France, that is how the whole thing started, and it evolved from there. Jeremiah came with a much more cosmopolitan attitude. He had been around the world. He had been on the SS France. He knew clubs in London. He had eaten in Germany. He really had a sophisticated palate, much more sophisticated than most people at Chez Panisse at that point. The two of them, coming from different backgrounds, were able to create this amazing food. It wasn't about anything specific. There was no agenda. There was no light at the end of the tunnel, like, why are we doing this? They were just passionate about it. I think, honestly, it is probably the most important thing that happened. Chez Panisse in the early 70s, Alice, Jeremiah, that collaboration. I think it is everything. Chez Panisse's reputation grew, garnering national attention and drawing a more and more fashionable crowd, to the horror of many of its founders and early customers. October 7, 1976, brought a seminal event into the life of the restaurant, and of American chefdom and cuisine. Tower conceived and prepared a Northern California regional dinner, treating American ingredients and preparations with the same reverence usually reserved for French food. The eight-course menu featured Spanger's Tamales Bay Blue Point Oysters, cream of fresh corn soup with crayfish butter, Big Sur Garapata Creek smoked trout steamed over California bay leaves, Monterey Bay prawns sautéed with garlic, parsley, and butter, preserved California-grown geese from Sebastopol, Monterey Jack cheese, caramelized figs, and nuts and pears from the San Francisco farmers market. It was a smash success. Jeremiah was able to be creative with menus, says Waxman. Alice was much more of a scholar in terms of cookbooks. Not that Jeremiah wasn't a scholar. He actually was. But he would take liberties with that and push the envelope. You know, injecting tangerine juice in a leg of lamb. That is pretty far out there for 1973 or 74 in California. But the two of them and that collaboration... I remember the menu had to change every day, 5 days a week. It was so amazingly provocative that it was incendiary. It was explosive. Tower, in a revelation that would repeat throughout the 1970s and 80s around the country, realized, we didn't know what you're not supposed to do. This is how you open a restaurant. This is how you run a restaurant. None of us knew. So we did the best we could, what we wanted to do. and as it turned out, it wasn't that bad. Let me tell you a story about Jean Toigrot. He came into Chez Panisse in 74 or 5 or something like that, and he came and ate in the dining room and came into the kitchen and said, "You know, I really want to meet you." And he walked in, and I nearly fell through the floor into a dead faint. My one hero who was not American. And he said to me, "Boy, I really envy you." And I think my heart nearly stopped. And I said to him, "You envy me? I mean, Jean, for God's sake, it's so much the other way around." He said, "Oh, no, no, no. You have the freedom to do whatever you want, and I have a 3-star restaurant. I can't do anything I want." And he said, "Would you please let me send my nephew Michel to come and do a stage here?" I said, "Well, Jean, that's going to make bloody history. No one's ever come from France, let alone from a 3-star restaurant, to do a stage in America, let alone in Berkeley." And he did. When Michel Toigrot arrived, he was just going to do beurre blanc sauces. That's it. And I'd say, "No, we're not." He would make the beurre blanc anyway, and, "We're going to put it on." "No, Michel, we're not." He couldn't believe it. So there was a strength in not knowing what you're supposed to do. It was a lesson that was repeated more than once. Says Tower, "Jean-Pierre Moulet, French trained from France, came to California, and he was my sous chef with Willie Bishop. There were 3 of us. And for the first whatever period, Jean-Pierre will tell you, he would just look at me like, 'That's not done.' I'd say, 'Well, this is a menu we're going to do.' And he was looking for what he thought everybody in France at the time thought. If you had a great restaurant, you had to have a great menu, meaning great ingredients, foie gras, duck breast, certain marks you had to hit. So he was polite but very resistant for a few months before he finally... Then, whatever food we were cooking, people would be always piling into the kitchen. And when they started to say, in those days they had been to France and come back, once a week at least, somebody would come in and say, 'We just ate at blah, blah, blah in Paris, and this is much better.' And Jean-Pierre heard that a few times and started to come around." Says Waters,
"Well, at the beginning it was the greatest collaboration. I mean, really, really wonderful. Because I think in some ways it put Jeremiah in a position of having to think about one menu, and to do it in a certain, if you will, Berkeley way, which was not his inclination, really, at all. But it helped us. It lifted us up to, or me particularly, into just worlds of food that I hadn't thought about. And it was great. It was really, really great. It was a period. Who knows whether it could have endured. What was great about it is that we were both, I think of ourselves as being intellectual cooks, and that we just went into every cookbook. He would say, 'Oh, well, should we do pâté en croûte?' I'd say, 'Oh, yeah, do that.' And I'd bring it out to the dining room and just sell it to the people who ate it. And we did all of those dinners for winemakers. We were in a real adventure of experimentation. You know, I'm kind of an olive oil person, but I sure made a lot of beurre blanc. It was an edible education for Chez Panisse."
Tower left Chez Panisse in January 1977, returning briefly in 1978 to help out Waters when she left for vacation. Many who were there from the restaurant's inception were delighted to see him go, allowing the restaurant to reclaim its original path. "There are 2 camps," said Tower. "There's someone like Daryl Cordy, the Sacramento wine expert and gourmet food shop owner, who sent a Sicilian mafia funeral wreath when I did the week of Escoffier menus, saying, 'This is the end. Chez Panisse can never be greater than this.' And the other camp is I destroyed the little Pignol movie neighborhood thing. And the truth is, you know, both." The Tower years at Chez Panisse foretold, though didn't necessarily influence, similar narratives throughout the United States. An American chef had found his way to center stage, and more would soon follow. Often drowned out by the opera of the Tower-Waters relationship, which would soon turn as sour as past-date milk, is that for all the interpersonal layers, at one level, it was a conflict between owner-founder and chef. Another theme that would play out not just at Chez Panisse, but across the industry and the country. 1. New World Order.
No, it might happen pretty easily, but the dream isn't big enough.
Norman Maine, James Mason, A Star is Born, 1954. How Wolfgang Puck led the restaurant reformation, creating a new industry template by putting the chef front and center, while a disparate group of expressive young Los Angeles cooks went their own way and into business for themselves. In 1975, not long after he moved to Los Angeles and took over the kitchen at the flagging French restaurant Ma Maison, a young, unknown chef named Wolfgang Puck hit a nightclub with Formula One race car superstar and fellow Austrian, Niki Lauda. Puck found himself slow dancing with a stranger. Who knows what the song was? Maybe Peter Frampton's Baby I Love Your Way, or another recent chart topper, Johnny Mathis's Feelings. Whispering small talk, he told the woman what he did for a living, which so failed to impress her that the moment the song ended, she bolted without a word, leaving him alone on the floor. I said, I'm not going to say I'm a cook anymore. I'm going to say I'm a race car driver, remembers Puck, whose voice, four decades later, retains its Austrian severity. Patrick Terai, Ma Maison's aristocratic playboy proprietor, wasn't burdened by such insecurities. Not anymore. With Puck in the kitchen, his restaurant found its footing and his stock was ascending. Studio executives, agents, producers, and other members of the Sunglass set were discovering Ma Maison in droves, making it their new canteen, a shabby, chic alternative to the Bistro, Chasen's, Musso and Frank, and Scandia, one of which had been around since the silent film era. The diametrically opposed existences that Terai and Puck experienced under the same professional roof weren't unusual. Owner impresarios had always been the face of their restaurants, the ones who put their money on the line, and to whom fame and fortune accrued. Chefs were the anonymous workhorses who toiled behind the swinging doors, rarely ventured into the dining room, and who, it was generally believed, were replaceable. But winds of change were blowing through the industry in 1970s Los Angeles. Thanks in part to the influence of Nouvelle Cuisine, food was shedding its uniformity. Chefs were attaining prominence. And a growing population of what would in time become known as foodies knew who was in the kitchen and wanted to be known by them. Eventually, the old model toppled, most spectacularly at Ma Maison, but also in a handful of restaurants where the traditional power structure was turned on its head, leaving owners stunned and chefs on top of the world. I don't care who you are, because my father's very rich. Patrick Terai was born into a world where restaurant proprietors were king. His family was industry nobility. Uncle Claude owned the venerable La Tour d'Argent in Paris. His great-grandfather, Claudius Burdel, had owned and operated Café Anglais, where he hosted Tsar Alexander II and Kaiser Wilhelm in the fabled Great 16, an opulent private dining room. His grandfather André, a pal of Henri Soulé, who would go on to open New York City's Le Pavillon, bridged the generations, relocating the wines of Café Anglais to La Tour d'Argent, of which he became the proprietor in 1910. In 1960, young Patrick, freighted with the great expectations of his lineage, came to the United States to matriculate at the Cornell University School of Hotel Administration in Ithaca, New York. Hospitality coursed through his veins, but the restaurateur within was first awakened at 30,000 feet when he spent a summer globetrotting as a Pan Am steward. The airline's caterer of record was Paris's Art Nouveau gastronomic temple, Maxime's, and Terai prepared everything from caviar and champagne to filet mignon and duck à l'orange. It's not like today, he says of in-flight service. It was very, very elegant. He went to work for Joe Baum's Restaurant Associates as assistant food and beverage manager at the landmark Four Seasons restaurant in New York City, where he absorbed Baum's vision and ambition. He was especially impressed that P.
People ate there every damn day. And not just any people, but captains of industry, and a who's who of the entertainment trade. James Beard, whose consultation had helped define the restaurant, regularly threw